for this morning is Appeal Number 093429, the University of Chicago versus Kathleen Sebelius. Mr.
May it please the Court, my name is Robert Kamenschein, representing the Department of Health and Human Services. Since its inception over 40 years ago, Medicare has been a program about patient care. The program pays teaching hospitals more than it does a non-teaching hospital for that care, only because it costs a teaching hospital more to provide the care. Thus, at Medicare's outset, it was made clear that pure medical research, valuable though it is, important though it is, would not be reimbursed by the Medicare program, as reflected in the Senate report that we quoted in our brief and as manifested in the reasonable cost regulations that were issued shortly after Medicare came into effect.
You know, I'm always skeptical in statutory interpretation cases when counsel starts with the legislative history.
Well, Your Honor, I think what we're trying to show is not just legislative history, but to show that over the course of the program, from the very beginning through the reasonable cost regulations, which specifically forbade reimbursement of pure research, that there has been an exclusion for this activity. This has not been a reimbursed activity. And what the hospital here is claiming is that at some point in the course of the development of the program, there was a transformation, there was a change in approach, and suddenly there would be reimbursement for this research. If there was going to be such a significant and dramatic change of course, one would suppose that it would have been flagged in some way. But it wasn't. Things just continued on, as we trace in our brief, through the various approaches to reimbursement right up to the present time. And as the MedPAC report that we cited in our brief pointed out, that the watchword for the reimbursement of these indirect costs of graduate medical education has been patient care, that while these costs are hard to figure out, maybe hard to identify, etc., the central proposition is that it's an attempt to reimburse the teaching hospitals appropriately for the extra costs that they incur that relate to the care of the Medicare patients. Now, the hospital, without any...
There seems to be some confusion here as between so-called direct and indirect costs. Now, your position is what with respect to that issue?
Well, Your Honor, the direct cost, I would point out that the hospital quoted the from the statement by the Secretary in the Federal Register in response to a comment in the notice and comment procedure that research was included in the reimbursement of direct medical education expenses, and the hospital says, well, if you include it there, why would you exclude it for calculating these hard-to-identify indirect costs? And as we pointed out in our reply brief, the Secretary went on in that very Federal Register discourse to clarify that the bottom line with respect to direct reimbursement of direct expenses was that there was no reimbursement for research that had nothing to do with the care and the diagnosis of the treatment or diagnosis of the patient. So one thing to keep in mind, again, is we're not excluding reimbursement for all research. And in fact, in the Rhode Island Hospital case, which has now been remanded back to HHS, the process there is to figure out the hospital claims that some of the research that was done by its residents actually pertained sufficiently to the care, to the treatment or diagnosis of the patient. The hospital is getting an opportunity to make that case. So when the hospital here talks about educational research in an all-encompassing way, we have to differentiate between the research that relates to the patient and the research that is long-range kind of research that a pharmaceutical company might do looking forward to a drug that would be developed in the future. Now, when we look at the regulation itself, the hospital here acknowledges that the critical term in the regulation, areas, can have a functional meaning. And the hospital then claims that the context of that of the regulation suggests that only a geographic meaning is appropriate, that it's more important where the resident happens to be than what the resident is doing. Now, the critical term here, the contextual term that the hospital omits, is subject to the prospective payment system. That system reimburses medical services. It doesn't reimburse a place. And so, if anything, the context supports a functional rather than a geographic meaning. When this reimbursement was proposed, it was proposed by Secretary Schweiker in 1982. In the report, we appended an excerpt to our brief, our principal brief, and Secretary Schweiker said, quote, indirect costs of graduate medical education are higher patient costs. The Secretary in a number of Federal Register documents has repeated that. Basically, there is a consistency of emphasizing the patient care rationale. It's not a question of all or nothing. The hospital here received partial reimbursement for its expenses. In Rhode Island Hospital, the hospital there received reimbursement. It may get more on this remand if it can show relationship to the care of the patients. So it's not an all or nothing proposition, either with respect to a reimbursement generally or even with respect to research. In terms of the underlying statute, the hospital's putting a lot of weight on a 1997 amendment which specifically referenced patient care, and the hospital says, well, now the statute mentions patient care for sites or outside the hospital, but it doesn't mention it within the hospital. But the secretary addressed that persuasively, and I think we think it's persuasive that what you already had in place was an emphasis on patient care and that nexus within the hospital, and what Congress was doing was to emphasize that that would carry over when reimbursement was expanded to activities outside the hospital.
That's not what the text of the regulation says. I mean, that's an argument from historical practice. And
Your Honor, we're talking here about the statute and the amendment of that statute in 1997 to deal with residents who engaged in care of patients outside of the acute care hospital.
Right, and we have a 1997 regulation to the pertinent regulation that limits reimbursement for residents who are assigned to a non-hospital setting.
Right. Correct.
To patient care activities, but the previous two subsections of that regulation that and in particular the first of those subsections that is in play here, does not
right.
contain the same limiting language. It was not similarly amended, and the usual rule is that where one right. subsection is amended and the other two aren't, that means something.
Right. I think the point is that that was a response to Congress amending the statute, and there was no need to go back and to, at least at that point, try to clarify what was already in place. Now, in 2001, because there was a ferment about this and hospitals began to question it, then the Secretary went ahead after notice and comment and put in a specific provision that said research unrelated to the care or treatment or diagnosis of the patient will not be reimbursed. But in 1997, when Congress acted, and the legislative history there shows, again, that Congress was aware that patient care was the watchword. So with the expansion outside the hospital, where Congress presumed what was going on was patient care, when you're going off the hospital to other sites, Congress wanted to emphasize that the patient care principle carried over to those sites. So it's a matter of emphasis. It's not a matter of saying there's nothing to suggest that Congress said, oh, if you're outside the hospital, then it's really important that you be doing patient care. But what you do inside the hospital, you know, if you're doing medical research related to some drug for 10 years into the future, that's okay. There's nothing to indicate that somehow being outside the hospital was special in that regard. And
Counsel, it would have been very easy for the Secretary to make this explicit
in
the regulations.
Was. And he did,
ultimately. When the system shifted from the reasonable cost reimbursement system to the prospective payment system.
Your Honor, that wasn't done.
And so, you know, the argument generally is if you didn't do it, right. you're kind of stuck with what you have.
Well, Your Honor, I would say this.
The regulations.
I'll stop. The reason we're here is to deal with an ambiguous regulation. Be nice if we had clarity. And an ambiguous statute.
What's ambiguous about it?
The regulation is ambiguous, as the hospital itself says, because the terms in the regulation.
It's unambiguous. The terms,
and as the First Circuit recognized, the term areas as used here can have both a functional and a geographic meaning. The hospital.
That's only if you read it in isolation, not
Your
in
Honor,
context.
I think that you have to read it with the language subject to the prospective care system. That prospective payment system does not deal with places, it deals with services to the patient. And so in reading it in that context, a sensible reading is to exclude reimbursement for basic pure research just the way it was excluded right from the beginning of Medicare and right from the outset in the legislative history of the Medicare program itself. Thank you.
Mr. Connolly.
May it please the Court, my name is Ronald Connolly and I represent the University of Chicago Medical Center. The University of Chicago expended considerable resources training physicians in 1996, and the Medicare program has committed by statute and regulation to reimburse the University of Chicago for the cost of this training. Here, the Secretary impermissibly removed educational research time from the count of full-time equivalent residents, or FTEs, when calculating
IME. You don't disagree with the general proposition that Medicare is a patient care program, do you?
Medicare is a patient care program, but that is not all it is. There are a number of activities that Medicare...
Pure research. Is this a corollary of that general proposition?
The Medicare program does cover educational research. The Secretary focuses attention on statements that she made in the early part of the IME program and statements that were in congressional committee reports indicating that IME is intended to pay for patient care costs. Well, there are three responses to that. First, if this Court agrees that the regulation unambiguously determines the FTE count based upon location, then these prior statements can't trump the unambiguous text of the regulation. Second, Congress intended the IME FTE count as a proxy measurement. In other words, the IME payment does not pay for the particular activities that the residents perform. It doesn't pay for patient care activities that they're performing. It doesn't pay for non-patient care activities. It's a proxy measurement. It's a widget that Congress determined statistically correlates with the cost that Congress intended to reimburse. The third response to that is that educational research has always been reimbursed by the Medicare program as a patient care cost. The Secretary focuses attention on an old reasonable cost regulation at 42 CFR 405.422 that excludes research that's over and above patient care. But that regulation has to be read in conjunction with another regulation that specifically says that education costs are costs related to patient care. And the regulation that discusses research specifically says that research activities that support the hospital's program needs are not excluded as reasonable costs. And so here we have educational research activities that are part of the hospital's approved educational program. They are educational costs, they're patient care costs, and they're not
excluded. Relate to patient care.
I'm sorry?
You got to relate it to patient care.
The concept in Medicare of patient care costs is not limited to what we refer to as direct patient care. That's hands-on patient care or diagnosing patients. That the concept of patient care is broader and includes all kinds of costs not directly related, overhead costs such as cafeteria accounting, so forth. These are all costs of patient care, and the Medicare program determined from the outset that educational activities were cost to patient care. And so we urge the court to...
The First Circuit held that neither of these interpretations of this regulation were, quote, completely beyond the pale, unquote, which struck me as a rather interesting way of evaluating them. And if they're not completely beyond the pale, isn't it preferable that we go with the bureaucrat's interpretation, which applies nationally and presumably will promote uniformity of interpretation here?
We submit that the First Circuit's analysis was incomplete. The First Circuit found ambiguity in the regulation primarily because the word areas has more than one dictionary definition. But the dictionary does not determine ambiguity because virtually all words have more than one dictionary definition, and if that were how we determine ambiguity, the Secretary would have virtual carte blanche to reinterpret regulations at will. When you look at the context of this regulation, it's apparent that the regulation is not ambiguous. The regulation says that to be included in the FTE count, a resident must be assigned to one of three areas: portion of the hospital subject to prospective payment, outpatient department, or community health center. And the district court properly relied upon the common rule of statutory construction that says when a word is used in one place in an enactment, it must be given the same meaning for other places in the same enactment. Here, the third area, community health center, is a physical location, and the Secretary has never contended otherwise. The district court correctly noted that an outpatient department is a physical location, and in a separate regulation, the Secretary has defined outpatient department as a specific physical facility that serves as a site of services. In 1997, the regulation was changed. That third area was changed to non-hospital setting, which is a physical location. And the Secretary has always interpreted it to mean freestanding physician clinics, for example. And so you have the word areas is used once to refer to three areas. The latter two are clearly physical areas, and so the first one must also be a physical area. And this becomes particularly apparent when one looks at earlier versions of the regulation, which also contained the key phrase portion of the hospital subject to the prospective payment system, but did not always use the word areas. In 1991, the regulation required that the resident must be working in the portion of the hospital subject to prospective payment. It used the words working in to indicate that the count is determined by a location in which the resident is working. For fiscal years prior to 1991, the regulations stated that areas of the hospital subject to PPS excluded such physical sites as freestanding family practice centers or excluded distinct part hospital units. Again, physical locations. The Supreme Court under Thomas Jefferson University also instructs that an agency's interpretation of a regulation is not entitled to deference if alternative indications of the Secretary's intent are demonstrated by her statements at the time of the regulation's promulgation. The Secretary's current functional definition is inconsistent with her statements at the time of the regulation's promulgation. Her intent then was to identify which residents were assigned to physical distinct part units that were excluded from the prospective payment system and to remove those residents from the count. In a September 1, 1983 Federal Register notice, she stated that the number of interns and residents assigned to an excluded psychiatric or rehabilitation unit may not be included in the calculation, referring to physical units. In a September 3, 1985 Federal Register notice, she stated that she had been including residents who were on call. These are residents who aren't even at the hospital, much less providing patient care. In a September 4, 1990 Federal Register notice, she stated that she interpreted the phrase part of the hospital subject to the prospective payment system to exclude, once again, distinct part units. These are physical units. And she stated, quote, "It is our experience that most hospitals currently do keep records that indicate the areas of the hospital where the residents spend their time. The count was determined based upon the physical locations of the hospital where the residents spend their time." The Secretary has published a manual called the Medicare Intermediary Manual that provides instructions to her auditors, the fiscal intermediary. And in section 4198 of that manual, she provides instructions to her auditors to use when determining the IME FTE count. And that manual instructs them to verify the location of the resident, uses the word location, and establishes a five-part test for auditors to use when determining which residents to exclude from the count. And those are residents in unapproved programs, working in another hospital, assigned to excluded units, once again units, replacing non-physician anesthetists, or assigned freestanding clinics. Nowhere in that five-part test is an instruction to evaluate what the residents are doing at any given moment, as the Secretary now contends, and to remove particular educational activities from the count. The District Court correctly held that this manual provision confirms that the Secretary's regulation contains no functional requirement. Prior statements all demonstrate that the Secretary understood the regulation to have a geographical requirement. In other words, if the residents were in an includable physical location of the hospital, they were included in the count. If they were in an excluded unit, they were excluded from the count. Five federal district courts have now come to the same conclusion.
We would be in conflict with the First Circuit, though, if we hold for you. So it would create a circuit split.
That is correct. However, this court has made it very clear that it does not defer to other circuits, that this court will perform an independent analysis. We note that since the First Circuit issued its decision, two district courts have disagreed with it. In addition to the district court's decision here, I would refer the court to the Eastern District of Michigan's extensive analysis of the First Circuit's decision in the case of Henry Ford Health System v. Sebelius, in which that court noted that the First Circuit did not analyze the context of the key terms of the regulation, such as outpatient department or community health center. That court did not analyze the Secretary's historical statements and really deferred to the Secretary primarily because the word areas has more than one dictionary definition.
Do you have a sense about how many reimbursement disputes on this issue are out there? I mean, this is an issue that will cease to have any relevance after the 2001 amendment. but I don't know if you have a sense based on your practice how many of these disputes are kicking around out there in other circuits or other districts.
I can't tell you how many. There are. I'm aware of a few, perhaps a half a dozen, but I'm really not sure about that. We do contend that the statute requires medical education research activities to be included, so this dispute may not go away after 2001 cost years.
That the statute is ultra-virus, or the regulation is ultra-virus?
That's correct, Your Honor. We contend that the statute requires all educational activities to be included, that it is on its face an educational adjustment that's determined using a statutory formula called the teaching adjustment factor, that this statute contains the word patient care in only one place, and that's with respect to time in non-hospital settings, and that's presumed to be intentional and does not apply to activities in the hospital. The statute requires the secretary to calculate the FTE count in the same manner as an adjustment in 1983. And that 1983 adjustment was determined based upon the employment status of the residents. It was a simple methodology that did not contain any kind of functional test to remove educational activities from the count based upon what the residents were doing at any given moment.
So there will be future litigation over the status of this 2001 amendment, making explicit what the secretary argues is implicit?
That is possible. The secretary contends that this statutory provision is ambiguous because it uses the term regulations. It requires that the count be determined in the same manner as regulations in effect in 1983, and the secretary had not published regulations in the Code of Federal Regulations, and because of that, the secretary argues that that word is ambiguous, and therefore the whole statute is ambiguous. That is not a reasonable interpretation of the statute, because to read the word regulations as applying only to the Code of Federal Regulations would write that word out of the statute. It has to be interpreted more broadly to apply to rules by the agency carrying the force of law, and those are the secretary's 1983 instructions. And I will note also that the secretary has acknowledged that this statutory phrase in the same manner requires her to, or forbids her from changing the substantive method of determining the FTE count. She stated this in the September 4th, 1990 Federal Register notice, acknowledging that in the same manner does bind her and that she does have to determine the count in the same manner as in 1983. We contend also that that even if this court determines that the regulation is ambiguous, that the secretary's interpretation nonetheless must be rejected as unreasonable. As was noted earlier, the direct graduate medical education count includes educational research. That direct graduate medical education count also has its genesis in the old reasonable cost regulations. If the secretary is right that these activities must be treated consistently with the old rules, then direct GME and IME must be treated consistently. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Kamenschein, how much time? You have 2 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Well, I think we have a consistent presentation here, because we still don't know, consistent with what the hospital said in its brief, we still don't know why it's more important where a resident is for purposes of the scheme than what the resident is doing.
Because that's what the regulation says.
Pardon?
That's the argument.
Well, that is the argument, but part of dealing with the question of construing the regulation is figuring out whether the interpretation that's being offered is a sensible one, as the First Circuit said, comports with the overall policy of the statute.
And the way we do statutory interpretation, counsel. We start with the text of the statute. And
well, Your Honor, we do start with the text of the regulation, and the hospital concedes that areas can have a functional meaning. You have to look at context. The hospital doesn't want to factor in the respective payment system implications of that language that's part of the part of that regulation. Much of what counsel said here is addressed in our reply brief. Counsel raises the doctors on call. We showed how that was basically half the story as to what the secretary actually did. There are other things like that. The direct medical education, similarly, the counsel ignores the point that emphatically the secretary said that pure research is not reimbursed under direct medical education. So there's much of what's been said here that I think is refuted, not just by legal argumentation in our reply brief, but actually what the secretary said. If you go back and look at the material on which counsel relies, the question of the outpatient department, we pointed out that you can have terms that where function and location coalesce. An outpatient department treats patients. There's no space between function and location as there would be dealing with research in the hospital itself. So I would respectfully suggest that the what was said here by counsel is completely and thoroughly refuted by our reply brief. Thank you very much.
All right. Our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.